Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A couple of months ago, I called up Peter Hessler, a staff writer who lives with his family in the Chinese city of Chengdu. It was just before our country had started going into lockdown, but Peter and his wife and his daughters had already been under strict quarantine since January, and he described exactly what that was like.
Convenience stores were always open, kind of like small markets were always open. A lot of people do stuff online anyway here. Like there's some guy upstairs about like a 100-inch television, you know, when you see them.
Peter is reporting now on the process of reopening China. And I called him last week to see how that was going. And because I, to be honest, was a little worried about some of this reporting. Peter, I hear that you went to a dance club. What on earth possessed you to do such a thing?
One of my former students was taking me out. It's a techno party. I was curious to see what, you know, is this really happening? Are people really going? And it was a club and, you know, it was mostly gay young Chinese. Chengdu is a pretty hip place and it's got a pretty active music scene. And, you know, the sort of the promo material was all about, you know, nobody else in the rest of the world can really do this. So let's show solidarity and have some fun, basically, you know.
And was it packed in?
Yeah. It was crowded. I mean, there really is. I mean, it's actually sort of a problem. I've been talking to epidemiologists. And because the lockdown was so intense here and so absolute, people didn't really develop the sense of social distancing. So people wear the masks. They know that that's important. But there's no, you know, space in lines or, you know, I was just on a flight from Chengdu to Hangzhou. There were 185 passengers. There was not a single seat empty on that flight.
Peter, when we spoke in March, you'd written in The New Yorker about your life in Chengdu. And it was, to be honest, like reading the future of what our life in New York would be just weeks ahead of time. So can you do that again? Where are you now in terms of the way people live in China? And how does the opening up process play out?
Well, I mean, I'm afraid I can't do it again because I think the future has diverged. That was the story at that point. Everybody was going through the same thing with the lockdown, but partly because China's lockdown was so intense, also because they caught things earlier. And also because mostly because of their intense contact tracing and testing, we don't have the same issues anymore. So my life now is, I think, not the life people in America are going to be having anytime soon. My kids have been in school for 3 weeks. I mean, they've got 54 kids in the class. They're all back. You know, they wore masks for 3 weeks and then the teachers got tired of it, clearly. And they, you know, let everybody take the masks off, basically.
So the masks are off in a classroom of 54 kids.
Yeah.
And people are feeling safe.
Yeah. I mean, you know, personally, I feel like they're going to always have things popping up because students and Chinese nationals are always coming back. But I think that they can contain it all. And when they don't contain it, like that's what happened in Jilin, they fire people. I mean, they fired 6 officials. So, you know, the system is built partly on fear.
What restrictions do exist? Is there any restriction on freedom of movement or the way people work in offices or in schools?
You know, when my kids went back to school, I mean, they take their temperature a lot. I mean, we have to take it every morning and send it to the school. And then, I mean, actually, they have their temperature taken 3 times by 8:30. You know, once at home, once in the subway station going to school, and then once as they enter the school. And then the school usually checks them in the middle of the day. So there's, you know, and we have to scan a QR code for each of the kids in one of these health code apps that they have. I have to send the college where I teach my own information every morning. So there's a lot of this stuff going on. And when you travel, you have these health codes, which are actually by city. So like when I made this trip last weekend, you know, I had to prepare 3 other cities' codes before I made that trip to make sure that when I...
I mean, China's a big country and not everybody, I presume, has a smartphone. What if you don't?
You could not travel in China now without a smartphone. So, you know, let's put it that way. You do need this to go to another city because if you go to a train station or an airport, they check it and they say, you've got to have our version of this. And it has to come up green. What that means is that if you've been somewhere where later there was a case turned up, the color of your code will change. And it would be yellow, which is like a warning thing. And then there's red, which means you're going to basically, you know, you've got to be checked.
And everybody cooperates. Nobody rebels against this.
No, not in China. No,
so when you see film of people in various parts of the country, in the United States, people defying the law, defying recommendations of the CDC. What does that tell you about the difference, if any, between Americans and Chinese?
I mean, there is a complete difference in terms of the response to things like this. And you know, in China, when they had the initial lockdown, people, you know, were very obedient, very willing to go along. But I think part of it is also that the messaging was much clearer here. I mean, you know, while we do have these protests in the United States, they have come at the end of a long lockdown period that was very open-ended and that was never presented to citizens in a strategic fashion. You know, they never told Americans it's going to take this amount of time, and while we're locked down, we're going to set up a system that makes sure that we can tell where this disease is popping up. And so, you know, in some ways, while those U.S. protests are crazy, I do kind of understand the frustration people would feel. Because, you know, where does this end? Where is it going? You know, they should have set this up. I mean, and that's what the Chinese were doing during the whole lockdown period, was setting up their systems to track things and to prevent future outbreaks, to be able to respond if something happens. The U.S. doesn't have that, so it's all just guesswork now.
Now, there's been talk of conspiracy theories in the United States about how the virus started, where it started, possibly in a lab, all this kind of stuff. And it's had been heavily trafficked online, of course. How is this all playing out in China? How does the official media describe what Donald Trump is saying and doing, and how the internet is discussing the conspiracy theories?
I mean, there's conspiracy theories here. I mean, you do hear from people that the United States started this and that it was brought in by the military and so on. I personally don't feel like people take that very seriously. You know, first of all, if the U.S. did deliberately, they should have been ready for it, right? I mean, it's not a very good conspiracy theory. You know, it's like a bomb that comes around and hits you. But, you know, they're aware of Trump, and people bring, I mean, when I went to the airport the other day, the guy, you know, running my bag through the x-ray machine, he's like, hey, what do you think of your president? But just like in a very joking way. I almost feel like they feel sorry for me, you know, and sorry for what's going on. There isn't this sense of...
What does that mean? They feel pity for the United States?
I mean, the government, obviously, the things the government says are different, but I'm talking about personal interactions. I've been here at many times, you know, when there have been tensions between the country and you feel a kind of anger on the part of people. It can be very tangible, very visceral. I have not felt that here. You know, when I talk to my students, they're very cautious about asking any questions about the U.S. You know, my daughters went to school on the first day back in school after, you know, a couple of months out, and... you know, their teacher made a point of saying Ariel and Natasha did not leave the country during this period, you know, just to let the other kids know that not to be afraid that they were carrying the disease.
What are the next steps for China until a vaccine arrives?
I mean, that's the big issue. And you hear different things from different people. I was just talking to a couple of epidemiologists in Shanghai, and one of them was very optimistic, and one of them was very pessimistic actually about a vaccine, because it, you know, they have not had great luck with coronaviruses in the past, and he had other reasons. So if there isn't a vaccine, then China could at some point reach a point where there's this great disparity in terms of how many people have had the disease outside of the country and how many people have had it in China, and they would probably have to adjust their strategy at some point. But, you know, I asked them, I said, so what's the long-term plan? And he said, there is no long-term plan. There's no country that has a long-term plan.
Peter, thank you, and all the best to your family. Talk to you soon.
Yeah.
Take care, man. Be well.
Bye.
Peter Hessler is a staff writer, and you can read him on China and many other subjects at newyorker.com.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.